Welcome, and it's very good to be with you in the ways that we can. I want to acknowledge that when we gather in this part of the world, we gather on Treaty One territory and in the homeland of the Métis Nation. I look out at the green, and from inside this sort of modern, contemporary structure of a home that we live in, and think that while I'm grateful for the shelter and the comfort, there are ways in which we have built things around us that separate us from the earth. And I'm really grateful to live at a time when some of the old ways in this part of the planet are being resurfaced, raised back into view, to help us be just maybe a little bit closer to the truth of who we are as humans, which is integrally connected to one another and to the world around us. Grateful to live and work on Treaty One territory. So let's take a few moments to breathe together this morning before we kind of get into our exploration. I'm not going to add anything to that today. Just let's in through our noses, cradle our breath, out through our mouths. An opportunity to be still together by choice for a few moments. Let's do four rounds of that this morning, and then we'll just jump in. All right, here we go. Be comfortable. Sit with your feet flat on the floor if you can. Somewhere where you can put your hands in a comfy place in your lap or rest them on your legs so they're at ease, so your body can receive the breath of life. Here we go. Let's breathe. Peace, everyone. Thank you. Thank you for breathing with me and allowing me to breathe with you, to share those moments of being alive together. Way back when, before I could even grow a beard, way before you could make an entire album on your laptop, I was a young college student. At that distant point in history, iconic musician Bob Dylan was struggling with his career and with his health. And in the midst of that struggle, he experienced a conversion to Christianity. Now, his conversion is a pretty interesting story in itself. It involves some curious things, a silver cross some fan threw up onto the stage one night, a fever that he had, a mystical experience in a hotel room, and eventually an immersive indoctrination in a fundamentalist evangelical vineyard church that had also welcomed some of Dylan's band members previously. One of the things that came out of that time in Dylan's life was the album Slow Train Coming. I listened to parts of that album again recently. A musician friend contacted me and said, have you listened to this thing recently? It sounds amazing. And I went back and listened to it, and it does sound great. It's a really fine sounding album. I mean, Dylan will never be regarded as a singer's singer, but musically, many people feel like he was arguably at the top of his game on that album, and the band on the album is outstanding. It's got this robust, kind of gently funky Muscle Shoals overall sound, and the Muscle Shoals horns play on it, and I am always a sucker for a good horn section, and that's a good horn section. So there's things going on there that I just love musically. The songs, well, lyrically, the songs were mostly pretty blunt instruments. They kind of bludgeon you with Dylan's newfound religious ideology. Greil Marcus, an American author, music and cultural critic, accused Dylan of, quote, selling a prepackaged doctrine he's received from someone else, close quote. In a similar vein, in a Rolling Stone interview, author and film producer Andrianne, she's probably best known for her film Contact. She said this: "The thing that I always loved about Dylan was the courage of his metaphors and the way he could cut to the bone of some kind of naked feeling. It always seemed pretty, it always seemed very gutsy. And now it seems that he's turned away. He's blinded by the light, and so he looks for some easy explanation." I think one of the reasons that got under Marcus's skin and bugged both critics and many of Dylan's fans is because Dylan was known as someone that thought for himself and that made his art from that sort of a place. He charted his own path, even when it was detrimental to his career. But I think for a lot of people in that time that valued counterculture in general, that, true to his path, felt like a reason that, to lean into his art as at least somewhat trustworthy. And even when he said or espoused values that, you know, they might not share. It's like we could kind of count on this guy to not cave into the establishment, to not, even if you didn't agree with him, you could count on him not to be a cultural sheep, not to just kind of go along with the crowd. So when he has this religious experience and then he comes out with an album that is full of ideas that clearly reflect an easily identified sort of my way or the highway brand of evangelical apocalyptic ideology, a lot of people felt like that was a net loss. Now, not everybody felt that way. The album did fairly well, not least of all because despite losing a bunch of his previous fans, Dylan gained a bunch of Christian fans of the kind of stream of Christianity that shared that ideology. Personally, I first heard the album in a dorm room at the fundamentalist school where I wanted to try to grow a beard, even though it was against the rules. A little aside here, in case you didn't know, kids' picture Bible books notwithstanding, at the point in history when I was an undergrad, God did not like beards. God has since changed his mind, and this is good. Anyway, Dylan also had a pretty big hit with the song Gonna Have to Serve Somebody, and so, you know, that helped. But despite the fact that one of his bandmates describes Dylan's conversion by saying, quote, the simplest explanation is that he had a very profound experience which answered certain lifelong issues for him, close quote, the conversion didn't seem to stick. Maybe the train of events that brought him to that intersection, to that conversion, didn't stop. Maybe the slow train coming that gave the album its title turned out to be more inexorable than anticipated. Maybe that train's last stop was not the ideology that Dylan had taken up with. Maybe that train kept traveling and took him to places that were not best explained by traditional Christian beliefs, to other places that, like the Christian place that he encountered unexpectedly, to other places that he never saw coming. As long as we're talking about trains and history, let's go back even further. September the 15th, 1850. There was the grand opening of the Manchester and Liverpool Railway. That might be your new fact for the day. I didn't know that before I read it this past week. Railways were relatively new. Commercial locomotives were extremely new. And the main feature of this event was the introduction of a new commercial locomotive named the Rocket. We probably saw that train going down the tracks. Now we would be like, the snail, but anyway, it was the Rocket in context. So one of the attendees of this, you know, significant occasion was a member of Parliament named William Huskinson. French-American historian and philosopher of education Jacques Barzun wrote that, quote, at the inauguration, he, that's Huskinson, was run over by the Rocket. No one as yet knew how to gauge speed and distance, when and where to step. Man's reflexes failed him in the midst of powers stronger than the horse and the ox. Huskinson, like all of us, knew how to cross the street. He did it all the time. He had a mental map for how to do it safely. That map was based on the speed of the vehicles he was familiar with, all of which, at this point in history, were drawn by either horses or oxen. And that map worked so well in those settings that he could apply it without conscious thought, the way all of us do when we cross the street. So when he went to cross the tracks in front of the Rocket, he looked up, he did his usual unconscious calculation, and he stepped out confident that he would be fine. He was not fine. And the reason was that his map of the world didn't include this new thing that was the Rocket. It didn't include commercial locomotives. He worked with his old, unadjusted map, and it was his undoing. I feel like I've been having a lot of conversations with people this past while about the uniquely challenging reality of the current stage we're at with the pandemic. This is a tough intersection. This whole thing, this whole pandemic has been, and of course, and is stressful. But right now, it feels like we're at this place where we can feel like we're really getting pulled in two conflicting directions at once. On the one hand, vaccines are here. All the way along, the dominant message has been it's vaccines that are going to get us out of this. So our imaginations, our minds have been trained, and they've been trained under some stress, which tends to drive ideas deeper into our mental maps, to the place where we kind of make sort of like mental bookmarks or mental signposts, and then we don't look at the whole map, we just look at the signposts. That's sort of happening with this message that vaccines are the answer. So our minds have kind of been trained to think that way. Well, so far so good, perhaps, at least in the sense that vaccines are a proven way of reducing the transmissibility and the severity of the virus and moving us closer to the recovery of some social aspects of our lives. But now, at the same time that the answer is here and increasingly available, we're being told to stay at home, to act in ways that don't feel like progress in the direction of moving out of pandemic mode, but instead feel like moving deeper into it. Now, stay with me here. I know this is contentious ground, and it could sound like I'm sort of setting up to take some kind of God told me how it is stand on vaccines or some other current issue, and that's not where I'm headed. The table isn't here to provide a tribal statement about God and vaccines, but it is here to make room for us to explore what we believe, which includes learning about how we believe. And how we believe, how we come to believe something, applies to everything. Not just to matters of faith or religion or spirituality. When we explore how we come to believe what we do about something like a vaccine, we're also exploring how we come to believe what we do about anything around us, including the sorts of mysteries we may choose to use God language for. These things, how we come to believe something is crosses the spectrum of things we believe. So that's where I'm headed. Now, one of the things that happens in situations like this is that when we feel the pull, we feel the dissonance between those two messages. And that can be a really tough space to be in. It's the kind of space where if we struggle with anxiety, which some of us do, this is exactly the sort of thing that can ramp it up. It's the kind of thing where if we didn't struggle with anxiety before, this could make us start to. And some of us, of course, you know, skip right past anxiety and cut to rage. And not to get too therapy-ish about it, but one way to look at that is to acknowledge that both anxiety and rage eat fear for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. They feed on fear. And if our root emotion is fear, especially unacknowledged, unconscious, or unprocessed fear, it's going to come out somewhere. And sometimes one of the ways it comes out is as anxiety, and I mean, there's other ways as well, and sometimes it's rage. All to say, this is a hard part of the pandemic journey because of those dissonant messages. The conflict between those ideas doesn't match the map we've been developing of, you know, pandemic without vaccine equals lockdowns, pandemic with vaccine equals growing freedom of movement and reduction of fear. So there's a disconnect between those two messages in our lived experience. And there's another more diffuse but very significant part of many of our mental maps that also doesn't fit with this current experience. And this one has been around for a lot longer than the pandemic. And for many of us, it's so deeply embedded that even when we try to access it in a conscious way, we find it hard to do so. And it's the idea that difficult things should be resolvable quickly. Or if not resolvable, then at least ignorable. We live in a get-it-now culture. There are fortunes being made daily on the perceived value of speedy delivery. Sitcoms have been training our relational imaginations for decades to think that interpersonal conflict can have a happy ending in half an hour. And we're awash in distractions. We're surrounded. Pick an area of life that is difficult, and I can point you to a product or experience that will take the edge off that feeling, at least for a while, and most of them are legal. Bonus. So it's not really a huge surprise that under those sorts of cultural conditions, we've also got a crisis of loneliness. We are herd animals. We need one another. But being in relationship also means being in complexity, because humans are complex creatures. And the kinds of complex that we are means, among other things, that some of what we most deeply long for and need doesn't come with a get-it-now delivery system. It's long-haul stuff. The kind that calls for things like commitment and determination, critical thinking and trust, as well as mutual commitment to working together through whatever the challenges might be, and we could go on with that list. Well, back to our miscalculating parliamentarian for a moment. There's nothing in that story about Huskinson and the rocket to suggest that he wanted to get run over by a train. He was, in his mind, just going about his day. What the story tells us is that he was crossing the tracks to meet a fellow parliamentarian that he had seen in another train car. The problem was that he wasn't equipped to do so under these new and unusual circumstances to such a degree that he didn't even know, he didn't even realize that he needed to make an adjustment. He just assumed that the paradigms he was accustomed to using would work just fine under these circumstances, as they had under the circumstances in which they were formed. It's not that he wasn't trained in how to cross the street. It's that his training, his map of the world, didn't match his reality, and he wasn't reconsidering or adjusting it. That process of reconsideration, of adjustment, of changing our mental maps, that's what exploring what we believe teaches us to do. Practicing that kind of exploration equips us for seasons of change. It teaches us how to be the animals that learn, how to do that uniquely human thing that makes it possible for us to adapt, to rewrite our mental maps, sometimes over and over and over again, as reality changes and requires those adjustments. This is something about the human experience that wise spiritual teachers and practices have acknowledged and illustrated for millennia. Zen, for example, teaches that it's impossible to add anything more to a cup that is already full. If you pour in more tea, it just spills over and it's wasted. The same is true for our minds. A closed mind, an attitude that says, I already know, may cause us to miss or waste important information. It just spills over the edge, doesn't go in. So Zen teaches that rather than an I already know mindset, we should cultivate openness. It teaches that the mind of the master is a child's mind, a learner's mind. And it refers to that quality of mind as humility. That's interesting to me. Indigenous wisdom keepers and elders have carried a similar value through the ages. As Wally recently reminded us, this value of humility, which is a core sacred teaching in most indigenous collections of teachings, this value of humility, of learning to understand our place within creation and to know that all forms of life are equally important, that can remind us to show care and concern for all of creation, to live with the world that is our home with humility. That kind of mind can keep us open to new experiences that illustrate our true place in the world, which is the place of being humble learners rather than hubristic knowers. Paul, that renowned interpreter of Jesus, taught that regarding others with humility is a path that leads away from self-destructive self-interest and toward healthier life in community. I wanted to distinguish self-destructive self-interest there from constructive self-interest, because another point in that same collection of sacred texts that we often call the Bible is the teaching that if we don't love ourselves, we can't love others. And so an important balance to that teaching from Paul, I think. All of these are possible ways of considering the importance of exploring what we believe, of being willing to adjust our maps for the reality we're actually in, rather than operating on the basis of an unexamined set of ideas, no matter how comforting or empowering that set of ideas seem to be in the moment. Think about Huskinson crossing the tracks. He was not distressed about the oncoming locomotive because his map said, not a problem. In contrast to that, there are some beliefs and some systems of belief that can make us more vulnerable to swallowing ideas without chewing them first. And these are sort of, this is broad brush stuff. I'm going to illustrate it primarily from, as you'll hear in a moment, primarily from the world of religion, because in many ways that's sort of one way to understand the context we're in this conversation. Religion or spirituality, systems of belief that include those aspects. But this, you could paint any number of things with this brush, as you've seen from the illustrations we've already explored a bit. Systems of belief that encourage or even insist that we believe without critical examination, that we are under authority in ways that mean we should check our own faculties and perspectives at the door, those are systems that make us vulnerable to being misled. Religion, which, you know, is a rather obvious example of systems of belief, is one realm where this happens. And can I just say, before we dig into this, this is not a conversation about intelligent people versus unintelligent people. There are smart people who believe just about everything that could be believed, and there are not smart people across the spectrum of beliefs as well, if we're going to categorize people into these two groups, which is a little too concise for my liking. But sometimes we encounter someone who believes something we don't find believable, and we're like, what are you, stupid? Right? And so, opposite of stupid, smart. That's where that contrast came from for me. This is not about that. This is about something else. And I hope I can unpack that a little bit for us. Religion is a realm that is full of systems of belief. Arguably, it is a cultural category that is built on systems of belief. And so it's a realm where this can happen. It's a realm where we can be taught to think or not think in ways that make us vulnerable to being misled. If you poke around a little bit in the psychology of religion, pretty fascinating stuff, you'll quickly find that it often overlaps with the discipline of social psychology in general. It's not a surprise, really. Social psychology is the study of how our thoughts, feelings, and values are influenced by others. If we don't think that applies to religion, then we probably have a belief about religion that would be worth some critical examination. One rather significant expression of religious ideology is the formation of groups, churches, communities, whatever we want to call them. But it's the formation of groups that share particular beliefs, or at least that share voluntary exposure to similar systems of belief. Now, a community that has some shared values can be an absolutely wonderful place. I hope we've all experienced the wonder of this. A community with shared values can be a place that gives us a sense of belonging and of safety and of encouragement, of strength to face and do hard things, a place where we can share our lives with one another, something that increasingly our communication-equipped society does not necessarily help us to do in person. And so community interaction can be a corrective for that in ways that we really need. And I hope that there are at least occasions where that's what we experience at the table. I know there are occasions where I experience that at the table, and I'm grateful for that. But communities can also be places that shape our thinking in ways that are not good, that make us less able to adapt, evolve, less equipped to rewrite our maps for life as required by the changing world that we live in. If our beliefs require us to not think critically, or to not question what we're supposed to believe, our minds are being formed in ways that make us more vulnerable to misinformation. And I'm not just sort of cooking this all up based on, you know, a couple of Facebook posts on some stream that I liked. People are starting to explore this more in depth and with more methods of study, and the results are quite telling. This past February 2021, the Pew Research Center in the U.S., large research center there, published an extensive study that revealed that 45% of the category was white evangelicals, in their study, that 45% of white evangelicals in the U.S. stated that they have no intention of getting the COVID vaccine. That was by far the largest identifiable group in the study clearly committed to vaccine denialism. In a startling contrast, that same study reported that 90% of people that identified as atheist either intended to get the vaccine or had already done so. Now, statistics, of course, are subject to interpretation, and it's not hard to find studies that will demonstrate that we can make statistics say just about anything. But that's a startling degree of difference and a remarkable strength of trend. Another extensive study co-authored by researchers, a collaborative project from Yale, Harvard, several other collaborating universities. This was a psychology department study. They were exploring the question of what common factors might exist among people that seemed especially vulnerable to fake news. And the findings of that study were that people who identified as dogmatic or religious fundamentalists, that is, as they defined it, those who belong to belief systems which discourage analytic thinking, open-minded reasoning, and skepticism, all things that at the table we would call exploring what you believe, that people who belong to belief systems like that, that discourage analytic thinking, open-minded reasoning, and skepticism, are more vulnerable to misinformation. Why? Well, because the things that we expose ourselves to train our minds. They form our maps for the world. And they form them in ways that, as they grow deeper and more substantial in our lives, become unconscious, like the way we measure the speed of things when we're about to cross the street. They represent to our brains and our minds and to the way we engage in many things in life, they represent what we would often think of as reality. But they're actually interpretations of reality. They're shortcuts for reality. And when we don't adjust them, when reality changes, we are vulnerable. If we're part of systems of belief where we are being told, don't think, obey. Don't be skeptical, just trust. Don't question, just believe. We are training our minds to not think critically. We are weakening our equipping for adjusting our maps as reality evolves and changes. We're making ourselves more vulnerable to misinformation. Not good. One of the implications is that when we find ourselves in situations where we need to think critically, to parse information, to make sense of the flood of data, if you will, we will not have the tools that we need. We won't have the tools of mind that we need. I have an acquaintance here in Winnipeg, and I just heard this story day before yesterday. I have an acquaintance here in the city who recently had someone show up unannounced on her doorstep. This is someone with a couple of young kids, a work-from-home mom under circumstances including the pandemic. So her home is a precious both living and working space for her. So someone just showed up on her doorstep under the current health orders. So that's a bit distressing already, an unsolicited visit. But she went to the door, and when she saw that the person on her front step was someone that she knew and trusted, she opened the door, what's up? And her friend just kind of launched right into it. Her friend asked her if she was planning to be vaccinated. And she said, yes, she was. At which point, her friend informed her that if she did so, she wouldn't be able to have any more kids. She would be sterile. And she wouldn't be able to get into heaven. And then her friend burst into tears. Clearly things she believed and felt strongly about. That's not theoretical. That's not musing about the training of the mind. That's a relational intersection of considerable complexity, for which I believe it is helpful to have some framework of understanding. That's what I've been trying to explore here for the last little bit. Jesus didn't use the analogy of maps or reference psychological studies in his terrain, but as a spiritual teacher, he was aware of this. This is human stuff, not pandemic stuff. This is as old as we are, this complexity. What's in our minds may have changed, but the thing we use the language of mind for, not so much. And when Jesus was talking about this complex issue, he referenced something a little more earthy than maps or psychological studies. He said it this way. He said, this is sort of a, I think Jesus must have really liked wine. Anyway, he said, don't put new wine into old wineskins. Don't do it. Why? Because the containers won't be able to handle it. At that point in history, wine was fermented in leather wineskins. What happened is that the wine and the skin aged together, and so the expansion that naturally happens when wine is fermenting, the bubbles it releases, the wine skin was able to absorb that and respond to it, and as that fermentation process settled down, the wine skin settled down with it, it matched the wine. It became a little more rigid. It sort of structured itself around the liquid that was in it. And if you put new wine into that old wineskin, it would just blow the wineskin apart. And Jesus makes that point in the story. He says, if you do that, you're not just going to lose the wine. You're going to lose the wineskin too. Like the whole thing is going to fly apart. Don't try to fit new reality into an old map. You're going to lose the reality, your grasp on reality and the map. You're going to lose the whole thing. It's going to all go sideways. New world, new map. And that includes systems of belief. They are not exempt from this. To return to our first metaphor, I would suggest that, which in case you've forgotten in all of this, was a train. I would suggest that the inexorable train, sometimes slow, sometimes not so slow, is change. How equipped we are to respond with strong, adaptable minds that are both willing and able to come back to our maps for the world and reconsider them and adjust as necessary for our changing reality. How equipped we are to do that has a great deal to do with what we've been training our minds to do. And exploring what we believe is one way we can train our minds to be quick, open, agile, learning minds. Jesus also said that to learn things that mystify us, to get into terrain that's new to us, to be changed, requires the mind of a child. By which he did not mean, and I can get into the research on this another day if you want, it's substantial and very interesting. The mind of a child is what Jesus did not mean is a mind that is under authority of an adult. What he meant was a mind that is endlessly inquisitive and open to the new learning that needs to happen, to taking things in and making a map for reality as those new things come in that matches that reality. All to say this, I love what we get to do here at the table. I love that we have a space, a shared space for exploring what we believe. I'm heartened by the evidence that kind of exploring equips us well for a world in which change is a constant. Change of every sort in every realm. Let's keep exploring what we believe together. I think it's both a great privilege and a great gift in our lives. Peace, everybody.